Welcome to Mentioned in Dispatches, the podcast from the Western Front Association, with me, Dr. Tom Thorpe. The WFA is the UK's largest Great War History Society. We are dedicated to furthering understanding of the Great War and have around 50 branches worldwide. For more information, visit our website at westernfrontassociation.com. It is the 15th of October, 2025, and this is episode 370. On today's Dispatches podcast, I talk to historian, journalist and author Nate Hendley about his new book, Atrocity on the Atlantic, published by Dundurn Press. This book recounts the shocking wartime sinking of the Canadian hospital ship, the Llandovery Castle, by a German U-boat in 1918, and the war crimes that followed it, and the subsequent war crimes trial in Leipzig in the early 1920s. Nate joined me from his office in Toronto.
Nate, welcome to the Dispatches podcast. Could you start by telling us a bit about yourself and how you came across this story of the Llandovery Castle? My Welsh is letting me down there.
Yes, well, my Welsh lets me down as well. I consistently refer to it just as the Llandovery Castle, which is probably the incorrect way to pronounce it. But yes, my name is Nate. I live in Toronto, Canada. I'm a journalist and I'm an author. Primarily, I've written true crime books, but I've always been interested in history. And I discovered this story totally by accident a few years ago. I was poking around on the internet looking for some interesting historical court cases involving Canada and stumbled across a reference to the Leipzig war crime trials, which I'd never heard of. Everyone knows about the Nuremberg trials after World War II, but lo and behold, there were war crime trials after World War I. And I read on, and it says the key case involved the Canadian hospital ship, the Llandovery Castle, and I was just flabbergasted because I read about history, and I've very well read about the First and Second World Wars. I'd never heard of this incident. And that's what got me intrigued in the whole thing. I figured if I didn't know about this, and as I said, I read about history all the time, I figured most other people have never heard of this either.
And unfortunately, that includes me. I hadn't heard of it until I read your tweet on the interweb. So what made you feel that this largely forgotten event in Canadian history needed to be retold in a full-length book?
Well, initially, that's a very good question, because initially when I came across this, I thought this might make an interesting magazine article. Ship attacked by a German U-boat off the coast of Ireland. Survivors were attacked after they tried to get into lifeboats. I thought, okay, there's enough material here for a magazine piece. The more I dug into it, though, I realized there were all these repercussions from this attack, that it set this incredible legal precedent at the Leipzig war crime trials. And this precedent was repeatedly cited at war crime trials in World War II and continues to have an influence today, that it influenced the constitution of the International Criminal Court. So I realized there is enough material here for a full-length book. This is not just a case of a terrible war crime that happened in isolation. There was this incredible repercussions from this event. I realized also that no one had written a full-length book about the entire story from start to finish. There are lots of books about bits and pieces. There's books about the brave nurses who are on the hospital ship. There are books about the Leipzig war crime trials that mention the Llandovery Castle. But I'd never seen anything that sort of put the whole story together within one manuscript. So that's really what motivated me to do a full-length book on this topic.
The Llandovery Castle attack violated international law and was followed by an attempted cover-up. What do we know about the motives and actions of the German U-boat commander?
Okay, well, the Llandovery Castle was torpedoed by German U-boat 86. And this is a U-boat captained by a guy named Helmut Patzig. He's a very successful submarine commander. He sunk about a dozen vessels while he's leading the U-86. And at this point in the war, we have to realize this is late June 1918. So a couple things are happening. The Germans are losing on the battlefield, that their big offensive in the spring of 1918 is running out of steam. Americans are pouring onto the battlefield. Eventually, there'll be a million Americans fighting in the First World War. So Germany is really the balance is definitely tipping in the favor of the Allies. At this point, too, Germany is absolutely convinced that the Allies are abusing treaty obligations. They think they're using hospital ships to transport munitions and soldiers across the ocean, which is forbidden by the Hague conventions. And they also have this bizarre idea that American pilots are somehow hiding out on hospital ships and going over to England to join the Air Force, all a bit of nonsense. So in 1917, the German Imperial Navy authorizes, unrestricted U-boat warfare, meaning that any merchant vessel approaching England can be sunk without warning. They also issue a series of memos authorizing their U-boats to attack hospital ships, only in designated zones, the Mediterranean Sea and an area from the English Channel to the North Sea. The Landovery Castle is nowhere near these zones, but it doesn't matter. The German submarine commanders still have this obsessive notion that hospital ships are now legitimate targets. And the Landovery Castle is not the first hospital ship attacked, I should mention. Throughout the course of the war, there were over a dozen hospital ships that were sunk in action. So that really was the motivation of the captain, that he seriously thought that this was a legitimate target. And when he was interrogating prisoners, some of the survivors of the sinking, he was absolutely convinced that they were harboring American pilots. And he kept hammering away at this. You've got American aviators on the ship. And the survivors were like, what are you talking about? Like, what are you going on? So that really was the motivation of the commander.
I wonder whether we could just step back a bit. I just realized that I haven't actually established when this happened, on what date, and how many casualties there were, and exactly, and more importantly, where it happened. I wonder whether you could just give us a bit of background detail before we go and look at the impacts of the atrocities at the time.
The Landovery Castle is a British passenger liner, and it's made by the Union Castle Company. The chairman of this company is from Wales, so that is why all ships made by the company are named after Welsh castles. We've got the Dover Castle, we've got the Landovery Castle. All these ships have similar names. It is during the war, the British government uses its authority to requisition passenger liners, use them in its military fleet. At first, it's a British troop transport. It's later turned into a hospital ship. This involves a massive, renovation of the interior. Hospital ship is not a transport that just takes wounded men back. It's got facilities for surgery, X-ray, examinations, medical rooms. It's used by the British government, and then the Canadian government basically purchases it. And it's used to transport very badly wounded Canadian soldiers from England back to Canada, where they'll probably spend months or years in recuperation. So it's heading back from Halifax in Nova Scotia to England, and there are no patients on board, but there's over 250 crew and Canadian medical personnel. Off the coast of Ireland, it's within, I believe, 100 miles or 100 kilometers of the Irish coast. It is without warning torpedoed by German U-boat 86. And it sinks very quickly, but a number of lifeboats are launched. And the lifeboats are intercepted by the U-boat, which has surfaced. The survivors are interrogated. The captain of the U-boat is convinced that they are violating treaty obligations and have American pilots on the ship. They're taking them to England to join the Air Force. When the captain realizes he's wrong, because the survivors consistently say the same thing, we're a hospital ship, we have no pilots on board, we are going back to England to get more wounded men. So the sub-captain decides to start shelling the lifeboats. And one lifeboat manages to survive. There's 24 members on board, 6 Canadian medical staff and 18 British crew. They are picked up by a British destroyer and rescued, and that is how word of the attack becomes known around the world. if the sole surviving lifeboat had sunk, then we might not have ever heard of this incident because the telegraph equipment was damaged during the torpedo blast. They couldn't get off a distress message. So nobody knows that this attack has occurred except the people on the U-boat and the people on the Landovery Castle. So in total, roughly 250 crew members and medical personnel are killed.
What's it? So we've established the broad narrative of events. So what impact did this atrocity have, both in terms of public outrage and political and military consequences?
Well, that was the interesting thing, that this incident had global impact, which I again was totally unaware of. There were front page headlines around the world, United States, England, Canada, Australia, all expressing outrage. And the interesting thing is at this point, this is a brutal war featuring, all manner of atrocities, be it poison gas, flamethrowers, mass death in front of emplaced machine guns, and yet some events still had the power to shock. Two reasons why this became such a sort of horrific. There are two reasons why this became such an explosive issue. Number one, there are 14 female nurses on the ship. They were all drowned when their lifeboat overturned. So nurses have a bit of a synchrosat image during the First World War. They're very seen as heroic, and the idea of 14 young women drowning in this freezing water really sort of captures the imagination and just horrifies people. And secondly, the notion of a sub shelling lifeboats is so blatantly against any kind of ethical or moral consideration that it really shocks people that even at this point, as I said, there's still some incidents that can shock people's consciousness. And those two things put together made this an explosive issue, and it was condemned around the world. Winston Churchill, then Minister of Munitions, made a speech about this. It was denounced in the British House of Commons, and leaders around the world sort of try to outdo each other with heated rhetoric about what they called Hun violence, Hun being a derogatory term for Germans. This was just seen as one of the worst incidents possible at the time. And as I mentioned, and we can discuss later, this whole thing, explosive as it was, soon disappeared from public memory.
And this brings me on to the case at the Leipzig War Crimes Trial. What exactly were the war crimes trials, and what precedents were established in this case, and how did
Sure.
they influence future war crimes trials? I think you've already intimated that this was an important marker or benchmark in their kind of
Absolutely.
legal canon.
The Leipzig War Crime Trials came out of the Treaty of Versailles. Among other measures, the Treaty of Versailles called for war crime trials of German political and military figures. And this was a very controversial idea because although we had at the time the Hague Conventions, and these are pre-war treaties that tried to regulate combat, war crime trials were something new. They hadn't really been done before. We're not talking about a court-martial. That's where an individual soldier is punished for individual behavior. We're talking about holding someone responsible for the actions of their men, be it a general or a commander. That's a whole new idea, and it was kind of novel. And the problem was there was no International Criminal Court at the time, and the Hague Convention didn't really explain how you're supposed to carry out a war crime trial. There's no precedent. So what happens is this period of negotiation occurs because remember, the Allies do not occupy Germany, or they do not fully occupy Germany. So they're not playing with a very strong hand. So they have to basically get the Germans to agree to whatever they propose. So the Allies say, we want to have war crime trials, we want to put the Kaiser on trial, and all these military leaders. The German government balks at this because we've got a post-war government beset by terrorists on both the left and the right, and they are terrified at the notion of handing over German civilians to be put on trial before Allied war tribunals. They fear a revolution will break out in Germany. So the German government proposes a compromise. We will host the war crime trials in Leipzig before the German Supreme Court. Germany will handle the prosecution and the defense. The Allies can provide lists of suspects, witnesses, and evidence. And there's a lot of grumbling, but again, the Allies are playing with a weak hand and they agree. Negotiations ensue. At first, the Allies have a list with hundreds of names on it. This gets whittled down and whittled down and whittled down. Eventually, less than 20 cases are heard. And interestingly, the United States has almost nothing to do with the Leipzig trials. The U.S. had entered the war with this burst of gusto, and now they're receding back into isolationism, that they don't really care. They're not involved with the Leipzig trials. They have almost nothing to do with it. It's primarily led by France and Belgium, and with Great Britain sort of coming in as well. And one of the trials concerns the Landovery Castle, that the Allies want to put Commander Patzig on trial. This is the commander of U-boat 86, which sank the Landovery Castle. There is a problem. Captain Patzig has returned to his hometown of Danzig, which is now a quote-unquote free city administered by the League of Nations. There's this very complicated post-war order, but essentially it means that he is out of reach of both Allied and German authorities. They can't arrest him. But the Germans are under a huge amount of pressure to do something. And so what they decide to do is they arrest the two lieutenants who helped their commander shell the lifeboats. These are John Bolt and Ludwig Dithmar. These are two guys who assisted the shelling of the lifeboats. And they are put on trial. They're rounded up, put on trial, and most Germans actually support them. They think that this is a totally unfair move and that they're being railroaded and they're put on trial. Trials are before the German Supreme Court. Most of the cases involve fairly low-level offenses. That one of the things about, unlike the Nuremberg trials, which involved generals and field marshals, these are trials about, you know, small-time actions by, you know, usually individual people. John Bolt, Ludwig Dithmar, two lieutenants from U-boat 86, are put on trial. They're not accused of anything to do with the torpedoing of the Landovery Castle. That's not on the agenda, though it totally violated treaty rules. The case solely concerns the shelling of the lifeboats after the sinking. And most people expect these guys will be acquitted, but the German Supreme Court surprises everybody and it convicts them. And in its conviction, in its ruling, the court makes two apocryphal precedents. It says, number one, international law trumps national law when it comes to war crimes. There are such a thing as sort of internationally accepted norms, standards, and ethics. And number two, following orders does not free you from culpability for committing illegal acts in wartime. So if you are ordered to commit something that is an obvious violation of every law on the book, you can be held accountable. This is a very new principle because most militaries at the time had the concept that you just simply blindly obey every order that's given to you. They're given fairly light sentences. Lieutenants are given 4 years in jail each. They quickly escape with the help of their supporters. And the Leipzig trials are widely regarded as a farce. Everyone denounces them. The defendants in most cases are either acquitted or receive light sentences. Everyone forgets about the Leipzig trials, but these precedents linger, and prosecutors in World War II recall these precedents set in the Landovery Castle case, and that's where it becomes hugely important. When the Nuremberg trials are drawn up after World War II, and these are the main trials focused on the top Nazi hierarchy, the constitution to the International Military Tribunal specifically disavows the superior orders defense, except as mitigation and sentencing, saying that you cannot use this as a defense. And they actually reject the defense of a couple generals, General Field Marshal General Yodel, for example, tries to use this, "I was just following orders." There are subsequent war crime trials besides the main ones at Nuremberg. A lot of people think that there's just the top one against the Nazi hierarchy, but there's actually a whole series of trials. The first one was in Kharkov, now Kharkiv, Ukraine, late 1943. Three Germans and a collaborator are put on trial for murdering civilians, mostly Jewish civilians, but the Soviet press decides not to mention that. And they use the defense that we were following orders from Hitler, and Hitler's law trumps, you know, anything else. Hitler's law trumps international law. And the Soviets say, no, no, no. 1921, German Supreme Court at Leipzig made this ruling in the Landovery Castle case that following orders doesn't free you from culpability, and that this the crimes they committed were violations of international sort of norms and law. All four men are convicted and hanged. The Leipzig verdict also is mentioned in subsequent other trials. The British military tribunal holds a trial in Hamburg for a German submarine that sank a Greek transport ship and, interestingly enough, tried to murder survivors. The crew uses this excuse of "we were following orders." The British court immediately brings up the precedent of the Landovery Castle and convicts the men. And the precedent also comes up at the Einsatzgruppen trial. It's an American military tribunal, and they're putting SS men on trial for committing horrific atrocities. And the SS men use the excuse, well, we were following a Führer order, and that trumps any international law, and therefore we can't be, you know, found guilty of anything. The American tribunal says, nonsense. This was established in 1921 about international law is, you know, trumps national law in these cases. And this is a gross violation of any kind of ethical standards. Therefore, obeying orders does not qualify as legitimate defense, and the men are all convicted. So it comes up repeatedly. I only use three examples in my book of where the Leipzig verdict was specifically cited at a trial. At a Soviet trial, a British trial, an American trial. And there were other cases, though, where this came up, and it continues to be an influence today. When the International Criminal Court was set up to prosecute war criminals around the world, its constitution specifically disavows the superior orders defense, just like the Nuremberg, the constitution of the International Military Tribunal at Nuremberg. The International Criminal Court also, by its very name, acknowledges the idea that international law trumps any sort of national law when it comes to committing gross violations of human rights. So in that way, it had an enormous impact, and interestingly enough, was largely forgotten by the public, but remembered by prosecutors.
So your research draws on letters, interviews, military files, and museum archives. What were the most powerful or unexpected discoveries you made in your journey?
Sure. One of the most poignant things I came across at the archive, Library and Archives Canada, they gave me boxes and boxes of material. And some of these included handwritten letters from members of the public who would say, "My son was on the Landovery Castle. Can you please give me any information? I want to know if he survived." These were sent to various Canadian military authorities because for several days after the sinking was announced, the list of people on the ship was not released. Canadian authorities wanted to be very careful about coming up with an exact list. Nobody wants to see their name of their son or husband or brother in the paper, and it turns out they weren't on the ship. So they're being very wary about releasing information. And so as a result, you get the slew of very just incredibly heart-wrenching pleas. "I need to find out some information. It was my husband. It was my brother. It was my father. It was my son." And these are very difficult to read because these are not, you know, facsimiles or something I'm seeing on the internet. I'm holding this in my hand, and you can see the handwriting in ink, sometimes not very well spelled. And these are just sort of, that's really when it hits home that this was a personal tragedy as well as a military war crime.
So Canadian service records seem to have been more accessible than British ones. What challenges did you face in actually piecing together an actual list of all the victims and survivors who were involved in the case?
That is an excellent question. The simple answer, and then I'll elaborate, I had no problem at all getting information from Canadian sources and ran into a brick wall with British sources. In Canada, Library and Archives Canada has digitized the service records of almost all personnel who served in the First World War. And these are publicly available now because they're over a century old. So you can go to their website, type in a name or just regimental number of a soldier, and you can get their entire record, 100 pages sometimes, with their background, promotions, incidents. Quite a few of these records, by the way, just have these very simple notes that says drowned, Landovery Castle, June 27, 1918. And it was quite easy to amass information that way. I discovered not so much with the British records. I had a great deal of difficulty putting together a list of the crew members. Because remember, this is essentially still a British ship. So the crew are all from Great Britain. The medical personnel are Canadian. Newspapers, by the way, in Canada released entire lists of every single Canadian on the ship. So this was released in like 1918. So I could, get a list of everybody from the Canadian side. A few British names were released. A few British names were released, but in the newspapers, but not many. And so I actually had to admit a note of defeat that I put in the sources in the back of my book. And I had to admit, honestly, I was not able to compile a full list of all the British crew members. I did contact several British sources. And at one point, the closest I got is I had to pay to receive a document indicating men who had changed posts on the land of the last voyage of the Landovery Castle, but it didn't include a full crew list. It just said, here's five guys and they decided to switch, and go to a different ship. So I actually found it very difficult to get information on the British side. And I don't know if I could have put together a full book if this entirely had been a British operation. So perhaps you can see that as a hint to archival sources in Great Britain. But yes, Canadian archival sources are widely available, easily accessible, and I use them profusely through my book. I have dozens of service records that I enlist in my bibliography from Library and Archives Canada.
We've been joined by the furry assistant who has woken up and was wailing down the corridor in your last bit of your last bit there. Now, what I find odd is I've heard about the Lusitania sinking in May 1915 and the German atrocity of that, but I've not actually heard about the Landovery Castle until you actually posted something on the interweb. Why don't we know more about it, and why has it been lost, I suppose, from British and also Canadian popular history, really?
That's an excellent question. That's one of the reasons I decided to do the book, was to find out. There's a bit of a mystery. Why did this disappear from popular memory? I propose a few theories. Number one, the Landovery Castle was sunk quite late in the war, late June 1918. The war actually ended just a few months later. So the Allies didn't have a lot of time to use this for propaganda purposes. There's some speeches, but there's only a couple posters depicting the Landovery Castle. The Lusitania was sunk May 1915, so the Allies had years to use this as a cause célèbre and portray this as the epitome of German aggression, blah, blah, blah. It helped inspire the United States to declare war on Germany in 1917. The other theories I have are, I described something that I call tragedy overload, that the human mind can only process so much horror. Everybody knows about the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Less well remembered is the firebombing of Tokyo that same year by conventional American planes. In some estimates, was even more devastating than the atomic bombings, but was almost completely forgotten. In Canada, we tend to focus on the Halifax explosion, which I'm not sure if you're familiar with. Two ships collided in Halifax Harbor, one of which was filled to the brim with munitions. It exploded. It was the biggest explosion in man-made explosion in human history until the atomic bombings. Thousands of people were killed. The city was leveled. Help poured in from across Canada and New England. So this really became the focal point of, if you talk about a tragedy involving Canadians in the First World War, people immediately deflect to the Halifax explosion, not to, you know, denigrate that at all, because it was a truly horrific event. But they sort of, you know, in remembering the Halifax explosion, they forget about another tragedy that occurred. It's sort of one tragedy too many. I also make the point there's simply little glory or gain from the Landovery Castle sinking, that unlike Canadian victories in battle at Vimy Ridge or Passchendaele, there's no sense of triumph. And it's sort of a grim, dismal tale in which lots of people were killed in a horrible way. I also mentioned in the 1920s, the Canadian public really wants to move on from the First World War. They erect a lot of memorials to the war. They have Remembrance Day events every year. But other than that, they really try to sort of put it behind them, because there's this sense of 66,000 Canadians and people from Newfoundland were killed in the war. And there's this real sense of, for what? What did it accomplish? There's also the realization that the Allies, too, had committed a few dubious ethical activities. The Royal British Royal Navy had blockaded German ports during the war, which caused starvation. And the Germans were outraged by the use of what they called Q-ships. And these are British warships designed to look like a rundown steamer. They would often put out a distress message, you know, help us. A German sub would sort of come up to it, and then guns would be revealed and they'd blast the U-boat to hell. And the Germans thought this is very underhanded, and, you know, maybe they have a point, I don't know. The whole thing, the whole point is, during the 20s, there was this sort of, not necessarily conscious effort, but there was definitely a move in Canada to sort of forget about the horrors of the war, and also a bit of cynicism that maybe our side wasn't as clean and glorious as people think, that we committed some terrible acts as well. So there's this sort of equivalency going on. And that really contributed to the forgetfulness. Then the fact is, simply was a Canadian ship. Lusitania had American passengers. So the American media, of course, 10 times bigger than Canada's, has turned this into, you know, the source of countless movies, books, documentaries, magazines. We simply, Canada can't do that. Our media is much smaller, so we tend to sort of neglect our own history to a great extent.
So coming on to my final question, what would you like readers to take away from Atrocity on the Atlantic?
I would like them to take away two things. There's the sort of historic legal aspect, which is that this terrible war crime involving a Canadian hospital ship set this incredibly important legal precedent that still rings true today, mainly that following orders does not absolve you of guilt if you commit an obviously unethical act. We're talking about extreme acts, by the way. We're not talking about unfortunate civilians being caught in crossfire, but a deliberate act of violence. A sergeant says, go throw some grenades into an orphanage or something. So there's the legal aspect, and just simply the human tragedy that these were, you know, over 250 human beings on this ship doing a peaceful mission, rescue, you know, taking wounded men back. This was not a warship. It had no guns on it, no armaments. It had a crew of from Great Britain, medical staff from Canada, including 14 nurses, and they were basically butchered. Those who survived the torpedo blast were shelled in their lifeboats. And I think we have to remember that, you know, human loss, and it's as I said, very poignant when you read letters from the relatives of survivors and the deceased, and they're just begging for information. So those are the two ways I'd like it to be remembered.
Nate, on that bombshell, I'll say thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much for your time, Tom. I greatly appreciate it. And this is wonderful to have the opportunity to talk about this very little known event in, I would say, world history, not just Canadian history.
You have been listening to the Mentioned in Dispatches podcast from the Western Front Association with me, Tom Thorpe. Thank you for all my guests for appearing on this edition. The theme music for this podcast was George Butterworth's The Banks of Green Willow. It was performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Krish Russman, and produced by Biz Records. This recording is part of a collection of orchestral works by Butterworth, performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, and supported by the Western Front Association. This is available from all good record stores under the record code BIS21. 95. Until next time.